ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 19th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, backlash against the axing of 350 full-time jobs at the National Science Agency. And for a long while, libraries were so quiet you could hear a pin drop. Now, they're welcoming a 10% jump in visitors.
Compared to other libraries in the world, Melbourne has one of the best-looking libraries. It has a lot of heritage, a lot of culture.
If I move somewhere, the first thing I'll do is go to a library and get a library card because there's so many workshops and events that, you know, libraries host and everything. So it's just a really good place for information.
President Donald Trump has downplayed the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in a Saudi embassy as he hosted Saudi Arabian leader Mohammed bin Salman at the White House. But it's a ghost of Donald Trump's past, his relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, which may come back to haunt him. The US Senate has passed a bill to release the Epstein files, an outcome Mr. Trump long fought to prevent, in the process driving a huge wedge into his MAGA supporter base. Nick Grimm has the story.
The yeas are 427, the nays are one.
Many Republicans believe it's time to end the cover-up.
The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
The Republican-controlled US House of Representatives voting almost unanimously to force the release of Justice Department files on the investigation into the crimes of Jeffrey Epstein. Just one Republican in the House, an ardent Trump supporter, voted against the motion, despite Donald Trump's backflip of recent days, pledging not to block the release of files after spending months insisting it was all a Democrat hoax. Today, the move was overwhelmingly backed by Republicans like Nancy Mace.
And I want every woman to know, every Epstein survivor to know, every woman across the country who is a survivor, who is a victim of assault, that we, today, we see you.
A short time after its passing in the House, Republicans in the US Senate agreed to greenlight and automatically approved the bill once the final paperwork arrives. Democrat Jim McGovern.
First, let me say how much I admire the courage of my Republican colleagues who are beside me here today. At the end of the day, this is not about us, and it's not about politics. This is about the survivors, young girls who were exploited by powerful men, men who use money and power to take advantage of girls, some as young as 11 years old.
Passage of the bill through both chambers of Congress ensures it will proceed to the US president's desk. He's already indicated he will not veto the bill and sign it into law. Even so, his key ally, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, is accusing his political opponents of a smear campaign.
Democrats are using the Epstein tragedy, the unspeakable evils that this guy committed with his trafficking ring and all of the abuses that they made these young women go through. They're using that as a political weapon to try to distract from their failures as a party.
The case has been a political thorn in the president's side for months. After amplifying conspiracy theories surrounding the case in his run for the White House, many Trump voters now believe his administration has covered up Epstein's ties to powerful figures and obscured details surrounding his death in jail in 2019.
She was manipulated, coerced, and threatened.
Sky Roberts is the brother of one of Epstein's most prominent accusers, Virginia Giuffre, who died by suicide earlier this year.
Epstein and Maxwell didn't just abuse her, they trafficked her to a network of the rich and powerful. Princes, prime ministers, politicians, financiers, and lawyers. These men committed unspeakable acts against her will, and against the will of countless survivors who stand united with us today.
For pundits, the vote outcome reveals the US president is vulnerable to losing the support of his key backers. Kim Hoggard is a former White House and State Department official for the Reagan and Bush administrations.
Well, we're seeing a slight crack in the support, the unwavering support that Trump has received from the right in America, whether it's in his base or in Congress from elected officials. I think people are now starting to realize that they can stand up to him. And I would just like to point out that it was women, certainly the hundreds of women that have revealed themselves to bravely spoken up for decades about the injustice that they have suffered. And it's going to have a significant effect on the remaining portion of his presidency, at least up until the midterms next year, when we see how that vote might affect the power the Republican Party retains in the Congress. So there's a shifting of the dynamics of politics in America at this moment with this vote.
Former White House and State Department official Kim Hoggart, ending that report by Nick Grimm. Back home, and as the states and territories remain locked in a battle with the Commonwealth over hospital funding, a new report by the Grattan Institute has found governments waste more than $1 billion a year in unnecessary spending in the hospital sector. Emergency talks today will deal with the Prime Minister's warning that the states and territories need to rein in public hospital spending if they want a funding deal with the federal government. Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
It's a pretty dire picture. Despite ever-increasing spending, Australian hospitals are unable to keep up with demand. Surgery waiting times are getting longer, staff are burning out, and ambulances are left waiting outside emergency departments. Peter Braden is the Health Program Director at the Grattan Institute and the co-author of a report into hospital spending.
They're trapped on this roller coaster of uncertain budgeting. The federal government is not really chipping in the amount it should. And so all of these ways that we fund the system don't set up hospitals to focus on getting the most care for the dollar.
The report shows Australia spent $87 billion on public hospitals in 2024, up 50% from $56 billion a decade ago. It describes the funding system as broken, with state governments setting unrealistically low budgets and then stepping in only when hospitals run at a deficit. But the report states that $1.2 billion could be saved if spending was put to better use, including reducing the time people spend in hospital, limiting what it describes as pointless tests and imaging, and using AI to improve efficiency. Jane Hall is a distinguished professor of health economics at the University of Technology, Sydney.
The first and probably most important thing that this Grattan report comes up with is state budgets. That state budgets aren't set around the nationally efficient price. They're set in a completely different way. And I think an interesting finding from the recent New South Wales Commission of Inquiry into Public Hospital Funding is that most local hospital districts do not understand their budget setting process. So we've got one sort of policy lever working at the Commonwealth level, but then completely different incentives and levers working at the state model.
She says there needs to be a better understanding of health system performance.
If you look at this report, there's one figure where they show most initiatives that have been taken to try and improve hospital efficiency have had no effect. Now, let's not waste time doing that. Let's have a solid research investment that really brings together and builds on what we can know about innovation and improving performance. And that was a recommendation of the midterm review of the National Health Reform Agreement.
The report comes as state and territory leaders are locked into negotiations with the federal government over public hospital funding. The federal government promised to increase its share of funding to 42.5% by 2030 and 45% by 2035. But Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the states need to rein in spending if they want the Commonwealth to honour that commitment. State and territory leaders are holding urgent talks today about how to proceed. Chris Minns is the Premier of New South Wales.
In 2023, the federal government said we'll get to 42.5% state-federal funding for hospitals. The latest offer we got from the Commonwealth was 37%. That's a massive, massive decline.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the federal government said the Commonwealth has increased its funding to hospitals in all states and territories by 12% in this financial year, and that the government is negotiating in good faith with state leaders over the hospital funding agreement.
Bridget Fitzgerald. The backlash is continuing over the axing of up to 350 full-time jobs at the CSIRO. The nation's premier science agency says a restructure is necessary to safeguard its long-term future. However, critics say the move represents a significant step backwards and have called on the government to step in and provide more funding. Luke Radford reports.
Australia's National Science Agency, the CSIRO, has had a hand in developing everything from Wi-Fi to AeroGuard. But its CEO, Dr. Doug Hilton, says there's one problem the organisation hasn't been able to solve.
Our funding is challenging. For the last 15 years, our appropriation, which is the money we receive from government each year, has gone up by about 1.3% per year. Inflation over that period has been an average of 2.7%.
Dr. Hilton says the result of those funding challenges is that the CSIRO needs to redirect money from its older programs.
And if you think about 10 years ago, we weren't talking much about AI, whereas now almost every program of science that we do thinks about AI. So we've needed to be able to hire people that are fantastic computational scientists, whereas we probably didn't need to do that 30, 40 years ago.
The equivalent of 350 full-time jobs are set to go to free up budget for the CSIRO's planned restructure, which it says also includes long overdue renovations and site upgrades. But with more than 800 positions already cut in the past 18 months, critics are fearful of what it represents.
I deeply appreciate what Doug Hilton, the chief executive at SIRO, has installed. These are not challenges of his making.
Ryan Wynn is the CEO of Science and Technology Australia, a body representing more than 200,000 scientists and technologists. He says the latest job cuts are indicative of decades of underinvestment by government.
Even without these SIRO cuts, across the OECD, the average gross domestic product spend of countries is 2.7%. Australia sits at 1.7, and that's a mile behind the OECD average, let alone global leaders in R&D like the US, Singapore, Israel. This is terrifying levels of investment.
Some crossbench politicians have this morning urged the Albanese government to invest more in public science. David Pocock is an independent senator for the ACT, where the CSIRO employs about 1,000 people.
We talk about future made in Australia, but we're not willing to actually invest in the research, that the science that will actually create those solutions and those jobs in the future.
Industry leaders say the issue goes beyond just jobs and the economy. They warn underinvestment in science will leave Australia strategically vulnerable during a time of rapid technological change. Professor Chenapati Jagadish is president of the Australian Academy of Science.
At a time when majority of the nations are really seeing science and technology as a strategic investment and then using science and technology as a way to really be able to influence the global decisions or so. So that means it's a challenge for us, and I think we really need to invest more in R&D and make sure that research and science is seen as an investment, not as a cost.
And he says it stretches far beyond just the CSIRO.
The entire sector has been struggling during the last 5 years, Rhiannon, and so many universities have cut jobs. Thousands of jobs have been lost in the university sector.
Federal Science Minister Tim Ayres has labelled the changes at the CSIRO as difficult but essential. He says the government believes in science and will continue to invest, but did not provide further details.
Luke Radford there. Well, after her predecessors unsuccessfully ran on crime in the last two state elections, Victoria's new Liberal opposition leader, Jess Wilson, indicated something of a demotion of the issue for her party yesterday, shifting focus to things like budget repair, healthcare and home ownership. The Allan Labor government has tried to outflank the opposition on crime, announcing several tough-on-crime policies. But in what some are calling a strategic shift, the Victorian government will now establish a new crime reduction unit, an emulation of the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit, which tackled youth crime in Glasgow.
So where some of these kids are getting picked up by police or are engaging in some at-risk behaviour, the early intervention officers will be the glue that will keep these kids connected back into the school environment.
Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen speaking this morning. Dr. Joel McGregor is a senior lecturer in criminology at Swinburne University. He joined me earlier. Dr. McGregor, in 2005, the Scottish city of Glasgow was rather unkindly referred to as the murder capital of Europe. It prompted the creation of the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit. What is it and what's its record for success?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit was originally created in Glasgow in 2005, and then its success was quickly recognised and it was rolled out to the whole of Scotland in 2006. And this was done because Scotland realised it really couldn't arrest its way out of rising violence, which I think is what's happening in our state now at the moment. So instead of treating violence as purely a policing problem, the Violence Reduction Unit approached it as a public health issue, so much like preventing disease. They focused on the underlying causes of criminal behaviour, so things like poverty, trauma, exclusion from school, mental health, substance misuse, and a lack of safe and pro-social opportunities for young people. And this was widely a success story. So over the decade that followed, Scotland recorded dramatic reductions in violence, including a substantial fall in homicides. So these improvements weren't the result of tougher penalties or tough-on-crime policies, but rather this long-term investment that Scotland decided to make on prevention, mentoring, school engagement, and community partnerships.
Community policing is not a new idea. Some Australian states have PCYC or youth police clubs to sort of help reduce truancy or form mentoring bonds between local police and at-risk kids. So how is this any different?
The Violence Reduction Unit goes much further than this. It's not just a program about building trust. It's a whole-of-government approach that brings together police, schools, health agencies, community organisations, housing and youth services to really tackle violence in a systematic way. So it doesn't rely on officers doing youth engagement, which really is kind of this idea of community policing, but rather it invests in evidence-based prevention and it supports social and emotional learning for young people through trained practitioners who recognise and respond to risk. And among other things, it's funding things like mentoring and education and employment, all the factors that we know, if aren't addressed, lead to an increase in criminal activity.
So how might this look in the Victorian state context?
A Victorian version, I don't think will look identical to Scotland, but it will reflect the local demographics and community needs. It's about coordinating school-based prevention, supporting community groups to do mentoring and cultural programs. And we're seeing this with 16 Yards at the moment. They've been kind of heavily highlighted in these announcements. It's about investing in prevention and providing training for practitioners to work with young people. So we're not clear on all the details at the moment, but we know that mentoring is going to be a big part. And we also know that school-based programs are going to be a big part of the Victorian solution.
So this is a long-term play, dare I say, longer than any term of state parliament. So do you think it will work?
Absolutely. I really welcome this announcement from the government. Tough on crime policies, we know, do not work long term. They lead to more arrests, which make people feel like they're safer, but long term, it does not work because they don't tackle the complex problems that lead to young people committing crime in the first place.
Dr. Joel McGregor is Senior Lecturer in Criminology at Swinburne University. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Tongans will be heading to the polls this week to elect their new parliament, but one set of seats will be reserved and can only be voted for by those of the noble class. It's a system aimed at balancing political power, but as Marion Kupu reports from Nuku'alofa, change is in the wind.
In Tonga, election season is in full swing. On polling day, voters would choose 17 MPs, and many want representatives who can ease everyday pressures, like the cost of living.
I will vote for the person who has love for the poor. Like myself, I'm not well off, and I'd like someone who helps the poor.
It's very important that they're community-minded and that they don't pick sides.
But observers say this election also revives a deeper question. 9 parliamentary seats are reserved for nobles and chosen only by the nobility. And recent moves by the Crown to regain some authority after democratic reform in 2010 have ignited debate about the role of the nobility in government. Former Prime Minister Celso Sovaleni resigned last year after losing the King's support and admits the relationship between the monarchy and government needs work.
If we're given another opportunity to do much better, probably can come up with a better way of cooperating or actually getting to address some of the issues they consider important.
Sovaleni is running for office once again. On the other side of the political divide, nobles like Lord Duvarno argue instability has come from limiting the king's powers.
All the turmoil we see today, in my view, comes back to this. Yes, what's needed is simple. Let the king choose the prime minister from the 26 MPs. If that happens, all these quarrels will stop.
Lord Duvano has emerged as one of two nobles possibly seeking the prime ministership, a major shift given nobles have rarely pursued the role since 2010. Political commentator Lopetti Centauri was an advisor to two former PMs and says the change is significant.
What we are witnessing is a reversal of the democratic changes that happened in 2010. And with that, I am worried that we may revert to a situation where it was necessary to make the democratic changes.
The king remains widely popular, and few oppose a return of some powers to the crown. But democracy is still highly valued by members of the public.
I support the democratic reforms in Tonga the way I see it. Overseas, they run democracies and you feel you have a lot more freedom. It's not like here in Tonga.
Tonga's shift to democracy took decades, and after Thursday's vote, the balance between parliament and the palace could shift again.
Marianne Kupu in Nuku'alofa. Librarians around Australia are pursing their lips to shush a whole new generation of visitors. There's been a 10% surge in library visitation and borrowing in just 12 months, and a boom in people using online resources. And yet, researchers say the funding of local libraries continues to dwindle. Here's Kathleen O'Connor.
It's just a few minutes before the State Library of Victoria opens its doors for the day, and there's a crowd of people waiting on the steps. Michael Lee is one of them. He uses the library for work.
If I don't feel like, you know, working at home or going to a cafe and just, you know, taking up space and spending money, I'll go to a library and it just gives me that environment to separate myself from home.
It's also a hub for those looking to do some admin.
I'm trying to print some resume to find a job in the area.
Others are meeting up with strangers.
I'm buying a lens. Camera lens. So it's just kind of like you never know who you meet on Marketplace, so it's probably safer to do it here.
New research shows libraries have been experiencing a boom in popularity. Jane Cowell is the president of the Australian Library and Information Association, one of two organisations behind the report.
There were 7 million participants in the programs that were offered in libraries, so there was a million more usage of the programs that were offered. We had over 174 million instances of collection usage. There were 14 million hours of Wi-Fi use across branches.
Loans of books, DVDs and other items are at their highest rate in 5 years, and overall loans have increased by 23%. Dr. Caroline Butler-Bowden is the librarian for Australia's oldest library in New South Wales.
This library alone, there are 296 inquiries a day. We are seeing a huge growth in HSC students, but students really from year 10, 11 and 12. They find the library an uplifting place, a place which is free from distractions, a place that they can really concentrate, they can meet their friends.
Heather Robinson is a research associate at Flinders University and wrote a book about why libraries matter. She says cost of living pressures are helping libraries flip their reputation as stuffy institutions for the educated.
Libraries don't require you to subscribe to any range of digital platforms in order to access movies, film, audiobooks. All of these things can be accessed through public Wi-Fi at your local public library.
But with more visitors comes more costs. The peak body for libraries says around the country, libraries need an extra $1 billion in funding to keep up with demand. Otherwise, many of the services will have to be scaled back. These library lovers say these public spaces are too important to lose.
Compared to other libraries in the world, Melbourne has one of the best looking library. It has a lot of heritage, a lot of culture in it.
And then if I move somewhere, the first thing I'll do is go to a library and get a library card because there's so many workshops and events that, you know, libraries host and everything. So it's just a really good place for information.
Library user Michael Lee, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Asbestos is banned in Australia and can't be imported. But in the last week, it's been found in children's coloured sand brought in from China. The discoveries led to the closure of dozens of schools, mainly in the ACT. Today, Anthony Linton from the Asbestos and Dust Diseases Research Institute on the health risks the sand poses. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.